the question was that what happens if you shift the gauge potential on Maxwell theory by a constant, you know, for vector? And I said that this wouldn't give anything interesting. It turns out it does give you something interesting, but that's not something new. This is obvious that if epsilon of mu is a constant, that the Maxwell Lagrangian is invariant under this. So there are four parameters here. So you can derive four currents, you know. And it turns out those four currents that are conserved are nothing but the Maxwell fill strength. So the conservation equation is nothing but the Maxwell's equation all over again. So the Noether charge associated with the symmetry is the Maxwell field strength here. The other thing was somebody asked me about the massive case. So if you add a mass term to your, you know, Maxwell Lagrangian, so you have something like this, and you say, okay, I want mass term, because in nature there are gauge bosons, sorry, there should be an M squared, which have mass. And this term explicitly breaks the gauge symmetry. But it turns out that there's a way of restoring the gauge symmetry by introducing a real scalar field with a kind of shift symmetry called the Stueckelberg field. And if you do that, then you can, you know, write down a massive gauge boson. The symmetry is no longer, the Stueckelberg is a real field, and the symmetry is no longer U1. It's an R that is the real number. It's a symmetry. It's a non-compact symmetry. However, I won't go into this because this is really outside the scope of this course. It turns out in nature, the gauge bosons which get symmetry are not, they don't transform under some abelian, they're not associated with an abelian gauge group. They're associated with non-abelian gauge groups such as SU3, SU2, and there is a U1 as well. The Stueckelberg way of giving mass to a gauge boson does not generalize to non-abelian cases, as far as I know. And therefore, another mechanism is needed, and that mechanism was provided by Higgs in the spontaneous symmetry wrecking. Okay, so there's another application of the Higgs symmetry, the Higgs symmetry breaking, and that's in a condensed matter system where you can think of type 1 superconductors, you know, the Meissner effect being the gauge boson photon acquiring a mass inside the superconductor and therefore having a finite, you know, range. And anyway, those are outside the scope of this lecture. So let me come back to our cliffhanger. So yesterday, you know, the quantization condition that we arrived at by demanding covariance. So here, you know, these are the annihilation operator with lambda is the polarization label. This was And as a result, and all the others vanishing, as a result, if we create a particle using the A0 creation operator, the norm of this state within, I should say quotation marks when I say norm, or I should say this norm, is a is negative, which is a disaster. So this, we will see, is an artifact of the residual gauge freedom we have. Remember that the theory that we quantized is the Maxwell theory plus a gauge-fixing term. And this is something that we always have to do. The gauge-fixing term depends on what, you know, you have freedom in choosing that. We chose a gauge-fixing term, which would lead to a covariant quantization, okay? More of the how to deal with the different classes of gauge-fixing terms will be covered by François in his path integral approach. Oh, by the way, something that I didn't mention, you know, as an aside, I just want you to work out is the mass dimension of the gauge field is one. And that you can work out from the Maxwell Lagrangian. Because if you look at the Maxwell Lagrangian, it has secondary, you know, it's like from the dimensional point of view, it is the same thing as, say, a scalar Lagrangian. It has two derivatives and two fields in each term. And that's exactly what the scalar Lagrangian has in its kinetic term. And that's how we determine the mass dimension. Whereas the Dirac Lagrangian had one derivative in its kinetic term. And therefore, you know, because the Lagrangian has to have mass dimension 4 so that the action has mass dimension 0, for the Dirac case, that led to the fact that your spinner had mass dimension 3/2. Okay, that's just an aside. Okay, so the classical, so classically, you know, we impose we had imposed this. And the Lagrangian we started with and then quantized the theory had this built into it. That doesn't mean that this equation holds quantum mechanically. In fact, if it were to hold quantum mechanically, it would be a disaster. So, for example, if you compute in the Heisenberg picture, we have been invaded by fifth grade monsters. Actually, they're pretty nice. This is the class, not this class, the class, the fifth, the same class last year, the same teacher's class. I gave a talk on cosmology, and they had some really nice and interesting questions. So if you calculate this, you'll find that this is the Feynman propagator. It doesn't matter exactly that it's a Feynman propagator. What matters is this is non-vanishing and that this is a scalar function. Not scalar, so not an operator. You always, whenever you take, you know, operators, the field operators and you know, in a bosonic case, and compute their commutators, you will always get something which doesn't have any operators, because you know that commutation relationship will just get rid of your operators. Now, if you apply the derivative operator to this equation, so this is a quantum mechanical expression, then if we were to impose this as a quantum condition, then the left-hand side would have this. And here, I'm just taking the derivative. This is derivative with respect to x, so this doesn't affect this guy. So the left-hand side vanishes, and you can verify that the right-hand side doesn't vanish. So we have contradiction, which means that this does not work as an operator equation. So, are we screwed? No. It turns out you can impose a much weaker condition. So, you can take your field operator in the Heisenberg picture and decompose them in terms of the part that contains the annihilation operator and a part that contains creation operator. So this guy contains a lambda of p's, and this guy contains a lambda dagger of p. And then impose this condition on your space of states. So you say that the states which satisfy this condition are the physically relevant states. And this thing has a name, this condition. The Gupta-Bleuler condition. So notice that the Gupta-Bleuler condition implies that if you take the Hermitian conjugate of this, that this is true. Now, you know, because the Hermitian conjugate of this guy is just this guy and vice versa, right? And therefore, if you now left multiply this by a bra of psi, sorry, and right multiply by there's a ket of psi and add those two things together, you get something that is that looks like the Lorentz gauge condition, but now, so the Lorentz gauge condition is still there, but as an average over the physical states. Yeah?
How is this, isn't there a technique where you introduce a condition?
Arc psi gauge?
Like arc psi. Like does it, you can, in Schwartz is how he does it, it adds a psi term to Lagrangian, that for, when you solve the equations of motion for this new field psi,
right,
it yields that Lorentz condition.
Maybe, I'm not familiar with that construction. Maybe there is, yeah. You mean it's a new field?
Yes, so in the photon propagator, you get this psi term.
Sorry, I'll have to look at that, but. Yesterday, we actually wrote down the photon propagator. You weren't here, but you know, but yeah, I'm not exactly sure what Schwartz does there. I'll have to look at it.
There's some gauges, like the Feynman gauge reset.
Right, so okay, so we are looking at a very specific gauge, a Lorentz gauge, which is the simplest Lorentz invariant gauge that you can think of. And there are generalizations of those gauges, which are, say, Feynman gauge, Landau gauge, those are examples of those. And in fact, Francois will actually do the quantization in a much more general gauge. Okay, so I'll have to, but exactly what you mean, I'll have to look at it, you know, so. Yeah?
P condition implies that, like, we cannot actually fix the gauge.
If you choose a gauge condition which makes the physical degrees of freedom manifest, that you don't have, say, a state with negative norm, that all your states are positive norm, then it turns out that that is in conflict with Lorentz covariance. So if you want to quantize if the theory in a Lorentz covariant way, it turns out that you always have to introduce states which are unphysical. But that a quantum mechanical version of the gauge condition will actually get rid of those unphysical degrees of freedom, as we will see presently. Is that what your question was, or something slightly different from you?
No, let me clarify my question.
Okay, yeah. So to look at the interpretation of this, let's look at the case. So let us choose our basis for polarization the dot product with the three component with the p vector is this, and the so this is a polarization that is associated with this creation operator A0, and we call the light-like polarization, or null, light-like polarization. So not light-like, time-like. And this is called sometimes a longitudinal polarization. And that's because it has components which are along the direction of propagation of your electromagnetic wave or your photon. So in this case, if you now work out what the Gupta-Bleuler condition means, right. So it turns out that it means that the third component and the zeroth component acting on your state will give you zero. So physically, what it means is that the negative norm states will cancel with the longitudinal states in physically measurable quantities. So for example, you can say, okay, what is our Hamiltonian? So this calculation is very similar to, say, the scalar field case, except we don't have a mass term now. So the Hamiltonian is given by this. And if you go through the calculation, you will get, formally speaking, d cubed of p So formally, all the polarizations will contribute to your Hamiltonian. But my claim is that if you now compute this for a state which satisfy the Gluck-Broiler condition. So if you compute this thing, then that will give you d cubed of p 2 pi cubed. There's a half, but the sum now will be over the physical polarization 1 and 2. I think there's a minus sign here. There's no minus sign, right? but for that to be true, I think there's a minus sign here. Sorry? Oh, yeah, sorry. That is also there. Psi doesn't disappear. The point is that this sum now only goes over 1 and 2. And to see this, it's easy, but it's worth doing, is what is the contribution from the term of a0 of p dagger a0 of p? And there's, because of the eta there, there's a relative minus sign between this term and the term, which we are calling a3. And then if you add a term if you subtract a term with a3 dagger, I should have p everywhere. A3 dagger p a0 p, and then, you know, subtract it and then add it. Then this just gives us this does give us two terms where the Gupta-Bleuler condition acting on the bra gives us zero. So this gives us zero. This gives us zero. So this is, of course, just a free theory, but it turns out that if you do, if you couple this theory to other matter, then if you start with an external state which doesn't have the longitudinal or the light-like or the time-like polarization, they will never be produced. That their contribution is always canceled out, in the intermediate steps. Okay. In my mind, P's and K's are the same, which is really not the case. So P, 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 P. So the take-home lesson is that covariant quantization involves working in a much larger state space. Which has both negative norm states and states corresponding to longitudinal polarization but imposing the Gupta-Bleuler condition ensures that the contribution of these states of these unphysical states drop out of physically measurable quantities. So that is all I have to say about ENM and its quantization. So our next step is to put all of this together into what is called QED, or quantum electrodynamics. I will do a calculation in detail in class, and I won't be able to do that today. Maybe start it, but not finish it today. But you know, we'll definitely finish it tomorrow. I won't skip any steps, at least any step that is involved or has subtleties. Okay. So quantum electrodynamics, in some sense, its success started the whole revolution of quantum field theory. A few years ago, I bought a book, an used book by Weinberg called Quantum Theory of Fields, Volume 2, on eBay. And he has in the introduction this line that quantum field so the whole book is practically new. There's absolutely no marking in the book, except in one place. In the introduction, Weinberg says, quantum field theory is the most successful theory we have of nature. And the guy who had owned the book before me had underlined it and written beside it, bullshit. So opinions vary, yes.
Can we get rid of the longitudinal and time-like polarization by fixing the residual gauge freedom?
Yes.
But here we just don't do it.
Yeah, and the price you pay for that is you don't have Lorentz covariance. You don't have Lorentz covariance. The gauge condition that you impose is not Lorentz.
If you put it back.
Yeah, so that's actually done in the Coulomb gauge quantization, actually does that. Yeah?
Can you, so for me, the annihilation and creation alternators here are something that depends on the bases that you choose, right? If you had expanded in another base, you would have different annihilation
Yeah, this is just an example.
Right, so, but this condition is independent of the bases that you choose, right?
Right.
Because it's just basically, del mu in mu is not zero, but if you sandwich between the psis, then...
Right.
Then
well, you don't have to sandwich it. It's much weaker than this. It's just that this acting on psi gives a zero. That implies, you know, this implies that if you sandwich both operators, the sum of both terms, so this, you know, plus and, you know, this minus, which is the same thing as, you know, the full operator with the, that this thing is zero. That is what it implies.
Because I think that looks better because that's like basis independent in a way.
Yes, this, I mean, this looks better, but this is not the condition you impose. It's what is implied already in this condition. But this is also basis independent. A, you know, sorry, I should not say a dagger here. I meant a plus here. It is also, you know, it depends on what you mean by basis, but, you know.
If I change modes, like, aren't negative energy modes always negative energy modes? Doesn't matter what kind of unitary transformation I do.
Negative frequency.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Those things are not, yeah, I think in flat space, those things are the same.
Okay.
Yeah. So, quantum electrodynamics, or QED for short, the Lagrangian for quantum electrodynamics is the following. You all have seen this t-shirt, right, with this master Lagrangian written on it, which explains, supposed to explain all of the universe. So little by little, you know, we are getting there, you know. So now you'll know a lot of what it means. So the it has a free Dirac Lagrangian, and it has an electromagnetic part, and it has an interaction between those two. So remind you what the Dirac part is. And the electromagnetic part. The interaction Lagrangian is given by E, which you can take to be positive or negative, depending on what you call, whether you take E to be negative, positive, you know, changes what you call particle and antiparticle. And then a vector current that is the current conserved, the conserved current associated with the Dirac Lagrangian. This is a charge current associated with the Dirac field psi. And it is coupled to the electromagnetic field in this way. Okay. So let's keep those implicit. And for gauge fixing, you know, you add your gauge fixing term depending on what gauge you're using. And for our case, we will think about when we quantize the theory, we will add this gauge fixing term. But before we go into quantum mechanics, you know, this Lagrangian is pretty interesting. It has some nice, interesting properties, and I want to discuss some of that.
So
yeah.
The gauge fixing term is the term I was talking about. You set the auxiliary field to one.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean so, there could be a psi field? Yes.
Yeah, if you multiply that by psi,
right,
and then you solve the Euler-Grand equation for psi, you'll get the Lorentz gauge.
Right. Right.
So
you basically, yeah, exactly. So.
So you set psi one. So I don't see why. Why would? What's so important about this Gupta, Euler, whatever?
There is nothing. So okay, what you're saying is, in the Lagrangian, you introduce some field like this, right?
Yeah.
And then that's just a Lagrange multiplier, right? And that imposes, you know, when you work out the equation of motion of the Lagrange multiplier, it just imposes your gauge fixing condition, right?
That's good, yeah.
Yeah, so.
So you're saying that was a problem, that was impossible before or something?
No, I'm not saying it's not possible.
But like the board right above you, you said this is a like classical thing that you...
Right, I mean, I want to talk about the classical symmetries of my Lagrangian before I do gauge fixing. And you know, that's why I'm not adding this to my Lagrangian, because this term will actually break those symmetries. You know, because it'll impose that gauge fixing condition, and I don't want to go there right now. You know, this particular Lagrangian, choice of Lagrangian, you know, your choice will depend on how you want to gauge fix your quantum theory. So, okay, so you know. okay, so. So yeah, so this gauge fixing will give you an equation of motion, which is the gauge fixed Lorentz Maxwell's equation. If you take the Maxwell's equation and you fix the gauge to the Lorentz gauge, then you find an equation that is Maxwell's equation in the Lorentz gauge. So if you add this Lagrangian, that's what you get. But that does not mean that, you know, when you impose the when you actually quantize your theory, when you impose a canonical commutation relationship, that, you know, the gauge fixing condition that is implied in this Lagrangian is automatically satisfied as an operator equation. It is not. And the Gupta-Bleuler condition tells you what is the operator analog of that? What is the analog of that condition? And that condition is not an operator equation. That's an equation that is a constraint on the space of states. Okay, and that constraint on the space of states is this.
The Gupta-Bleuler condition is specific to the Lorentz gauge.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think so. If you had that psi term there. Then when you did the variation of that, you would have got del mu mu equal to zero as an operator equation, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be what you want? I think that's what you want.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. I don't understand the distinction that you just made.
Right, yeah, I don't want that. That, okay, so you're saying, yeah. Sorry? So you know, yeah, I'm not imposing these equations as the gauge condition as as I said yesterday is that the theory that we quantize by adding the gauge fixing condition is a theory that is a slightly different theory. It's not really the electromagnetic theory, you know, but at the end of the because we are actually quantizing the theory in a particular gauge. And there is no other way you can do it. You know, you have to choose a gauge before you're quantizing the theory. If you don't, then you get unphysical, you know, degrees of freedom, and things will go horribly wrong, okay? So, I mean, there are different, so if I had, you know, so if I introduce a psi here, right, but my that would give me some modified Maxwell's equation, and the modified Maxwell's equation would have some psi term in it. But now psi is itself some field, so we have some equation of motion that that is related to psi, and that would give me one extra equation, which would be the Lorentz gauge, and then we could combine those two equations and get back to where I was before.
Equals zero as an operator, so I don't.
No, that's not. No, it's not. You know, when we are deriving those equations of motion, we are still at a classical level. They are not operator equation. Okay, why don't we kind of discuss this outside class? Because I think, you know, this is really not. It's not going to help us. Okay, so we of course still have our favorite phase symmetry, where alpha is, you know, alpha is a global parameter, meaning it doesn't depend on space-time. And the associated current that is conserved is this guy. However, now look at in the interaction term, our gauge field A mu, you know, appears explicitly. You know, it doesn't come in, you know, in the unlike the kinetic term. In the kinetic term, A mu is packaged in F mu nu, and we knew that under a gauge transformation, F mu nu is invariant. But this interaction term is not invariant under our gauge transformation. So I just realized in my notes where I said that that term is not invariant under gauge transformation, I actually didn't write down the gauge transformation. Okay. So remember our gauge transformation was of this form. And we see that the interaction term is obviously not invariant under this. And in fact, it's true, our full Lagrangian would not remain invariant under this transformation unless when we do this gauge transformation of the, you know, gauge field, we also made this transformation of the spinner field, where psi goes to psi prime. It is related to this. The E is the constant that appears in our Lagrangian. So now I'm specifying this parameter alpha to be the same as this one, and therefore this guy does depend on space-time points. So this is not a global transformation. And then psi bar goes to psi bar prime. So let me prove that under this extended gauge transformation, our Lagrangian does remain invariant. And to see this, let's look at our interaction term. Our interaction term under this combination you know, this goes to the same term. we want to keep that term. But now it picks up this extra term with E psi bar, a derivative acting on the on alpha. So this is what, this is a new term. But now if you go back to our Dirac Lagrangian and look at the kinetic term, you find that the kinetic term, you know, transforms in this way. So this, you know, a new term, it picks up a new term. So these two terms, you know, exactly cancel each other. Notice that even in this local transformation, gauge transformation, the mass term, because there is no derivative in the mass term remains invariant. So our conclusion is, when we do the gauge transformation of the gauge field in this way, if we simultaneously transform our spinner and its Dirac conjugate in this following way, then our total Lagrangian remains invariant. Now these two transformations look very much like our global phase transformation, where we have allowed the phase, global phase, to become a function of space-time. So this procedure by which you take a global symmetry of your Lagrangian and then make the parameters of the transformation local, it's called the gauging the symmetry. And this is a rule of thumb by which one can introduce interactions in the theory. So you have some global symmetry, you gauge that symmetry, and you see what changes you have to make in your Lagrangian to actually make the whole Lagrangian invariant. And then often you'll find that that introduces interactions between the different fields. Yes, Florin? Exactly. You don't get the kinetic one.
Okay. Is there a way that we can actually argue that we have to have this kinetic one?
No. No. It could be some other kinetic term. In fact, you know, those will be the gauging. Usually, the gauging principle,
gauging a symmetry does not tell you what the kinetic term of the new field is.
Can you please specify which part is gauging this?
Yeah, okay. So this is, as I said, it's kind of a rule of thumb. It's not, you know, there might, as far as I know, there is really no deep sort of understanding of this. You know, there are probably a case by case, but they're usually like on hindsight. So this is a global symmetry that we had. So you suppose you start with some Dirac Lagrangian as a free theory, and you had a global symmetry. And then you said that, if I take now alpha to a space-time dependent function, that is what I call gauging a symmetry, then my Lagrangian is no longer invariant. However, if I now introduce an interaction term where there is this new field, then if that new field now transforms
as a gauge field, then the whole Lagrangian is invariant. Let me, so that's basically the symmetry we're gauging. So note that, even though this Lagrangian now has this extended gauge symmetry, this global symmetry is still there. And therefore, charge is still conserved. Noether's theorem applies to that part of the Lagrangian still, so charge is still conserved. So before we break, let me just quickly go over the scalar field case. So consider the complex scalar field, so sometimes called a scalar QED. So this has some complex scalar field phi and some electromagnetic field and some interaction term. Those guys are this is the same as before, so I won't write that, but L phi is a complex scalar field, so you can write star, but I write dagger. And it has some mass term. And the interaction term that we write is this. So this is the charge, the current that is conserved associated with the global transformation like this. This Lagrangian also has a gauge symmetry. And so if you make these transformations local, and so if you say I think I'll choose an E here. Okay. So there is clearly something happening here, and there's actually something more geometric happening here, and to see what's happening, we can introduce, say in the case of QED, a covariant derivative. So define a covariant derivative acting on a spinner. Field is this plus I E of mu acting on psi. Okay, I just noticed that I dropped the psi from the second term in my notes.
And then if you can show that, you know, if you do this gauge transformation, and I think, yeah, let me just, you can, you know, write the gauge transformation like so. If you write it, then you don't have to introduce the factor of E in your phase, the phase rotation part. So if you do this, then you can work out that this thing transforms in this way. So this we called a covariant derivative. And in terms of the covariant derivative, we can write the Lagrangian for QED now as psi bar I gamma mu, now big D mu, minus m of psi plus electromagnetism. This extra term coming from this covariant derivative is precisely the electromagnetism, the coupling between electromagnetism and your spinner field psi. So let's take a 5-minute break and meet back here. But yeah, you had a question? Yes. The gauge fixing condition that we have chosen, that still makes the Lagrangian invariant. If you had not chosen a Lorentz gauge condition, say a Coulomb gauge, then of course the Lagrangian will not be Lorentz invariant.
That means we cannot choose Coulomb gauge.
Sorry? You can still, yeah, you can still, no, you can. It's just your quantization, your theory will not look covariant. That you're, you know, when you're actually, you know, you're actually choosing a reference frame to quantize the theory. So, but in the Lagrangian, yeah, the Lagrangian will not look covariant if you, if you add a term that imposes a non-covariant.
So in this frame, the Lagrangian does not depend on the coordinate matrix, but in some cases, it does.
Yes, I think if you're trying to do a quantization that is not Lorentz invariant, then you know the Lagrangian will not look Lorentz invariant because you're adding some gauge fixing term which is not Lorentz invariant, and therefore you know.
And what does the constraint on the state mean? So is that also another gauge, or is it just a constraint on?
So, you know, I don't exactly recall the Coulomb gauge quantization, but I think it turns out that from the very beginning, you only have two polarization, and therefore you would actually not have any, you wouldn't have to impose any, I have to check, but the Hilbert space that you start with is the physical Hilbert space in that case.
But we still have some residual symmetry in.
Yes, it doesn't, we still have some residual gauge degrees of freedom, but I don't think that, I'm not sure if that, that actually causes any trouble. But I have to check. I really have to check. I haven't done the calculation in the Coulomb gauge. So, the fact that your gauge fix action is no longer invariant under the gauge transformation should not be a surprise, because your gauge symmetry is not a symmetry. It's a redundancy of description. And gauge fixing means that you are using up your freedom, that redundancy. But there is a tension between using up all that freedom
and Lorentz invariants. And that is what's manifested in the Gupta-Broiler quantization procedure. Okay. So like in the case of QED, you can also introduce a covariant derivative for scalar QED. So you can say, okay, this I define to be and then the Lagrangian for scalar QED takes a very elegant form. There are no interaction. The interactions are hidden now in here. So this covariant derivative should ring a bell. You saw that in GR, you have to, the covariant object derivative, one of the derivative is the covariant derivative, and the covariant derivative acts on a vector field, say in this way. And when you do a coordinate transformation, which is again a kind of gauge freedom because it's a redundancy of your description. You know, general relativity, the whole name means that it should not matter what coordinates you use to describe your physics. So if you do a coordinate transformation, then the covariant derivative tells you that things will transform nicely. So the geometric interpretation of the covariant derivative is that it minimally couples the field psi to some background gauge field. So a covariant derivative so minimally couples psi to some background field A mu. This is the geometrical interpretation of the covariant derivative. That background field can itself be a dynamical field. If you introduce the Lagrangian, the kinetic term for that Lagrangian, you make that dynamical. But you could have chosen some specific background field. So this is analogous to, so in GR, this means that you're coupling some vector field V mu to some background gravitational field. This is also called a connection. Gamma mu nu rho, the Christoffel connection. So you can think of this, the Christoffel connections are a form of potential for your gravitational field. Yeah? So the answer is kind of circular. Minimally means that you are, the only interaction between your field, the vector field V or your spinner field psi, to the gauge field is through a covariant derivative. Because you could have added other terms. So for example, in GR, you know, suppose you have a scalar field phi, you know, your Lagrangian has some action, which is the Einstein-Hilbert term, but then you have some scalar Lagrangian. But here, the scalar Lagrangian, you have to use the covariant derivative, right? In the case of, and it may have a mass or it may not have a mass. Now, the minimal coupling means, and then you can have, say, let's a vector, say you have some vector field, say V mu nu, and it's coupled, say, like this. See that your gravitational field, which is you know, described by this and this vector field, they don't have a term like this. So there is no term where, you know, G mu nu, well, that's actually not true. In this case, it does. Okay, what I mean is that, you know, say your lambda or something, you know. Okay, so you could introduce more interaction term, which could actually not be repackaged in terms of, say, the covariant derivative. So for example, you'll see theories where the scalar field actually multiplies your Ricci scalar term. So this is an example where this is not minimally coupled. Whenever the coupling is not through some, you know, covariant derivative or something, that means that it's not minimally coupled, right?
In relativity, we understand the connection as a change of the basis if we move along certain direction, if we consider the embedded barter.
Right.
But how can we interpret the covariant derivative in that geometry?
Right, so the way to, you know, there's a whole mathematical formalism. Which it gives a more well-defined version of this. And what you do is that you think of, so so you know, you have some kind of a space-time. This is your space-time. And you have some field living on space-time, say in this case some spinners. So I think of it as some, you know, some spinner vector, you know, spinner space attached to every point in space-time. And what these, you know, covariant derivative tell you is that, you know, if you like take your spinner on the and go around in a small loop, then on this spinner space, you know, you make some rotation. You don't come back to the same, you don't come back to the same point. So you started with the same point, this point on the spinner space, but as you go around, you actually, you know, don't come back to the same space on that spinner space. These are called fibers. And the gauge, you know, field tells you how, you know, how this thing changes. And there's a whole, you know, machinery of, you know, having called fiber bundles, and having the basic notions of fiber bundles is useful for the geometric picture. I've never found it useful in physics. But, you know, there are other people who have, so. So let's get back to real life and write down the Feynman rules for QED. So So we've already seen the Feynman rules for fermions. So we also have additional Feynman rule for photons, but the photon Feynman rules will depend on what gauge we have chosen, because the propagator will depend on that, right? Because you'll see in the next course, what we call the propagator is the, well, you already know this, that it's the inversion of the wave operator that is in the, you know, that comes in your equation of motion. And your equation of motion depends on what gauge you've chosen, right? So now we have this extra term, L interaction, and this will tell you, give you a new, a new interaction term. So photons are denoted by a wavy line, and this is a fermion, and the arrow tells you the flow of charge. I'm writing this down with no time orientation. You can turn this around, you know, and it'll be, so there's no time orientation implied here. And the photon, we associate a space-time index mu. And for this thing, we will write in our Feynman rules a vertex factor minus IE gamma mu. So this is our first Feynman rule coming from the interaction term of QED. But we also have a photon propagator. So photons are wavy lines with the ends denoted by some space-time index mu or nu. And in the gauge that we have chosen, the propagator is, in momentum space, is given by this. Very simple. If you had not fixed your gauge, then you can show that the propagator you get is singular. So the wave operator you get for the unfixed gauge, Lagrangian, has zero eigenvalues, and therefore you cannot invert it. And if you try to invert it, you get a singular object. And there will be a tutorial to that effect, I think, in QFT2. Yes?
In the first picture you do, would there also be space-time index on the left side, or
no,
on the right?
No. if these are external fermions,
then they will have associated spinner factors associated with them that I gave in the when I discussed the fermion. Feynman rules, but no, they don't. Because photons, this comes from the fact that the photon actually has, you know, polarization. Some people will actually write the mu here. I've seen that too. Okay, so we already know what to do for incoming and outgoing fermions. Yeah?
When fermions scatter with the photon, the first diagram is the polarization, which is the spinner index of this fermion changes, can be changed after scattering, or it remains fixed?
Well, it depends on the time orientation. So if time is going right, then that will describe a fermion, antifermion, kind of annihilating and creating a photon. But you can show that that can never happen. due to conservation of momentum. That the rules of the game will tell you that a fermion and an antifermion can never actually disappear and become a photon, even though there's a vertex. This is unlike the phi to the power 4 theory, where there's a vertex of four scalar fields, you know, interacting, and there is actually a diagram in the interacting in theory where that happens. Maybe that could be a good tutorial question. Okay, so the incoming photon so some photon is coming in, some momentum P. You associate some polarization vector with that. You know, it'll depend on what polarization the photon was created in. And for an outgoing photon, you have the complex. Conjugate of this. So in your homework, the third homework that I'll post maybe today or tomorrow. Oh, by the way, I just wanted to make a quick announcement about the homework. Your homework will be due at the end of your first week of QFT2. Okay. And it's not very difficult. It's interesting, but I don't think it's fairly long. It's not fairly long. So okay, your homework, in your homework, you will figure, you'll write down in detail you'll work out the cross section of what is known as the electron positron scattering. So the electron positron scattering. He's also known after this Indian physicist, Bhava scattering. And the diagrams, the leading order non-trivial diagrams are these, where, you know, an electron comes in and a positron comes in. So as usual, for me, time flows sideways. So an electron with, I'm not gonna use the three momentum vector notation because it's a pain. But external particles are always on mass shell. You have to remember that. And they have some spin polarization S. And then K and R is the positron coming in. And, you know, and there is a photon propagator. And then the photon creates another electron with momentum P prime, S prime, and a positron with momentum K prime and R prime. And I will switch to that side because I'm running out of I don't like the corner there. Okay.
That's not the only diagram at that at this order. You could have had the electron coming in and emitting a photon and going out, and the emitted photon could be absorbed by an incoming anti-electron or positron, and that would scatter off to a positron with momentum k prime r, spin poisson r prime. Call this mu, call this nu, and the momentum that is flowing is p minus p prime. And just for completeness, let me redraw that diagram here, because I like having my Feynman diagrams next to each other for a given process. And it's always good to practice Feynman diagrams. Right. Okay. So there is some vertex space mu, and then and you can actually, for the given initial and final states, these are the only two diagrams that you can draw. And I should decorate this with the flow of charge, like so. So you already know all the Feynman rules for this, yeah? Because that's not consistent with the external state. Okay, what's the diagram you were going to? Okay, so you were thinking the U channel would be this guy coming in and this going here, right? The 1 and 4, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So then that would not violate your charge conservation, because then the arrow would have to flip, because you see there's an electron coming in, but this is a positron going out. And here, your detectors, you can tell in your detectors what is an electron or what is a positron. One has positive charge, one has negative charge. So so if you were to connect this with this, then you see that the sign at the arrow, the direction of the arrow flips. So the matrix element for this guy is given by So this is one term, and which term is it? It is the second one, yes. Because this first factor comes from this guy. So you take the fermion arrow and you go against it, and so, this one, okay. It actually comes from this guy, the first factor. You take the fermion arrow and you go against it, and here you see that it was an incoming positron, so you write the positron V bar factor, and then your Feynman rule tells you that for this vertex mu, you have to put minus I E gamma mu, and then you carry on moving against the arrow, and then
you write that there's an incoming electron, and you write the factor for the incoming electron. And this guy is a scalar. All the spinner indices here have been contracted. And then you write down the photon propagator, and then you do the same thing over here, and then you get this thing. And this is also a scalar, so you can actually move these two things around, you know. And then there's a minus sign due to Fermi statistics. And I think in the tutorial you did a version of this where the internal particle was a scalar, right? This was the second problem in your tutorial. And there you found that there was a minus sign. Here the minus sign is exactly the same. The fact that it's a photon does not in any way affect that argument that you figured out in tutorial. And this is gives you a U bar of S prime P prime minus I E of gamma mu. Right, I forgot the other term. So this is going to be this thing. So I'm going over here, and I reach this point, and I see that there's an incoming electron. Right. This is an outgoing electron. I write a U of S of P. And then I write the photon propagator for this guy. So I have minus I eta mu of nu, and then P minus P prime squared plus I epsilon. And then we do the same thing for here, go against the arrow. Okay, let's put this in a big bracket. And here we have V bar of R of k, this is the incoming positron, vertex factor for the incoming positron interacting with the photon propagator, V of r prime of k prime. Okay. So in next class, yeah?
When we were doing last class, didn't we go like backwards in time to find out the V's and the U's?
No, you didn't go backward in time. You went against the arrow of the charge flow. So, you know, okay. So time here is going this way, okay?
And just right. Again,
okay, so this was this term, right?
Yeah.
So you have two fermion lines.
Right.
Pick one. Doesn't matter which one. It could be this one, it could be that one.
Mm-hmm.
Time does. But once you, so I picked this one, right? And I picked one, and I saw that the fermion line has arrows in it. And what I do is that I start going against the arrow. So when I start going against the arrow, I see that this is an incoming positron. For positron, you always have a V or V bar associated. But because it's, you know, it's the first thing incoming, you write a V bar. Okay? And then for this, you write the vertex factor, and then you see there's an incoming electron. So you write the electron factor. Yeah, you have to go against the fermion line. And it doesn't matter which one you did first. And why I'm saying that is because this thing is a bilinear in the spinners. And if you see, it's although there's a gamma matrix, all the spinner indices are contracted. So this object is just a number. And this guy is also a number. So if you had just started here, then you could have written this factor first and this factor second. This would not affect your calculation. As long as you follow through your fermion line, you're safe. Okay. So before we finish for the day, let me just give you, tell you what we are going to do next. I haven't told you, okay, yeah. We'll try to do two calculations. One is, suppose you have a QED that involves both electrons and muons. So you have a Lagrangian, which has an electron part. So this is the mass of the electron. And this is the mass of, this is the field that creates and annihilates the electrons. But you also add to this another fermion, which is a muon. This is not a space-time index. This means it's a muon. Okay. Let me just, this is the mass of the mu particle. Okay, so this is muon. So this actually appears in the standard model. And see that there is no direct coupling between the muon and the electrons. But they can still interact with each other. So for example, in next class, we'll consider in detail how an electron and an anti-electron coming in with these labels. And a photon propagates, which then becomes a muon and antimuon. So this is a little bit like the Bhava scattering, except, you know, the final states are no longer electron and is not an electron positron, but a muon. But because there is no direct coupling between the muon and the electron, this is the only diagram at this level. The other diagram, the T-channel diagram, is not present. Because if you were to write a T-channel diagram, then you'd have to do this. An electron has to come in, and a muon have to go out. So any a positron will have to come in, an antimuon will have to go out. But this is not, there is no interaction term like this in our Lagrangian. Yes?
Can you just explain why the three mu bars, or is one of the intentional?
Thank you. So the other thing is that you see this. So this would, you know, then you might say, okay, you know, quantum mechanics is weird. You know, maybe some higher loop diagrams will give me like something like this. The answer is no, it can't. And that's because this Lagrangian has two U1 symmetries. This is a global symmetry, where this is the electron operator. But it also has a separate symmetry, a completely independent global phase transformation. So the muon charge and the electron charge are separately conserved. All right, so I'll stop there. And next time, we'll actually do this calculation in fairly painful detail.
But I think it's good because then you get to see, you practice some QED calculations, right? Yes, Florian?
At this point, if we have two global symmetries, we could try to gauge them both and end up with two separate interactions involving two different potentials, right?
But we chose to have the same photon coupled to both. If you had chosen two different kinds of photons, then there would not be interaction between these guys. That's a very good point. These D's, in this case, are the same. You see, if they were different with different gauge fields in them, then there would not be any interaction between, at a second order level.
Talk to each other, right? We could write down
FPU1
times
FPU2. Oh, you can always couple the photons, yes. Yeah. You can always say, okay, I could have photon number one and photon number two, and we have, this would, respect your gauge symmetry. You can always have, you'll have some, coupling of photons. You could do that, yes. Yeah, you can always cook up theories like that, yeah.
What kind of photon
in the world? Well, by photon, I mean a U1 gauge boson. Yeah. All right?